Hello, welcome to Time to Say Goodbye. It is a very special episode. Today is March 13th, and we're recording this on the 12th, and it is a day that I have been anticipating for a while, and I'm sure that my guest, Vincent Cunningham, has been anticipating more than me. It is the release date for his debut novel, Great Expectations. Vincent, welcome back to the show. I don't know how many times you've been on. You might be, at this point, our most repeated guest. It's you. It's either you or Wah, you know?
I'm not counting or anything, but I think I'm beating Wah.
Okay. Our number one repeat guest. Yeah. welcome back to the show. How do you feel? Your book's out in the world finally. I mean, I've been hearing about this book for a long time, and
you know,
novels are hard. And yeah, I'm just so excited for you, man. How are you feeling this morning now that it's finally out in the world?
It's out there. After this, I'm going to go to some bookstores to check it out, maybe sign some books. And it's crazy. I don't know. How did you deal with it? I mean, you've done this twice now. Like, what am I supposed to do? I feel like, oh, wait, I was working all this time and now here it is.
Well, the first one, I actually honestly don't remember because that was when Grantland had just started, right?
I remember very well. I went and bought that book when it came out.
I was so busy, and I think it was nice in that I kind of forced myself to be too busy to think about it. And then it came out, and then I did a few events, but nothing really, you know? Like a couple of bookstore events. I think I did something with Eddie Wong in New York City, right? And actually, I think I did something with Wah too.
Oh, cool.
And, but it felt very odd because I think I was still in this mode where my life still seemed quite unreal to me. You know, I was like, I've been thinking about this happening forever. And then I always thought it would be this big landmark moment in my life, right? You're a young writer, you think about it. When you're like 12 years old, you think about it. You're like, you walk through a bookstore and you're like, what would it be like if under the K's, like my book was there?
That's right.
And then you realize that, you know, that there's nothing that can happen in the actual life of the writer that will live up to those expectations.
That's right.
Because everything's just weird. But then you also feel, I don't know, I at least felt this. When I did see it, I felt like I would say, oh, I don't know. You know, a few hours of great satisfaction. I think that that is enough, right?
Yeah, like, I'm just trying to enjoy it, yeah.
Have you seen it yet? Have you, like, snuck out and gone to look at it at bookstores or anything like that?
Not yet. So after this, I'm going to stop by a couple of bookstores to sign some of the stock. So I will see it, hopefully, in some, you know, displays. And I'm sure that's going to be a surreal thing. But I'm just trying to, like, party, like, act like I won the NBA Finals, and then see where it all evens up. This is my plan.
You're like a Deshaun Stevenson after the Mavericks won the title, who partied for like 10 straight nights and then became a legend of the game for that reason. That's a good idea. Yeah, I think for the second book, because it was COVID, it was kind of anxiety. It wasn't anxiety inducing, but everything was over Zoom, which also made it kind of unreal. But the same thing happened. I went down to the bookstore here in Berkeley and I saw it and I felt like, great. I remember I don't know if I should be telling this story, but Bill Simmons, who I believe appears in your novel, right?
he's mentioned.
He's mentioned, not by name. I remember I talked to him at some point and he was telling me about Book of Basketball reaching number one in the bestseller list, and he sort of said, I called my dad and I was happy for 10 minutes and then I felt it. He sort of said he felt his great emptiness, you know. And it was, I don't know, I always loved talking to Bill about writing.
That's very
funny,
yeah,
because he was like, well, he is, you know, somebody who thinks quite a bit about writing. I think it's something people might not expect about him. And he's read all these columns. Yeah. He has sort of encyclopedic knowledge of it. But that was quite funny. And I think his experience was very relatable. But then it comes and goes, you know? And then sometimes what's your relationship with the book at this point? Like,
like it, which is amazing. Like, sometimes I'll just open up to a page or two and be like, oh, you know, I think I did what I set out to do, mostly. Of course, you know, if you are a writer, you're on some level usually a perfectionist. And there's times I'm like, oh, well, whatever. But honestly, I'm very proud of this book. I think it's the best thing I've ever done, which is takes a lot for me to say. But
yeah, well, let's talk about it then. It is I don't want to describe it too much because I think that it, you know, I don't know. I think as writers, it's hard. Like, nobody wants to hear their work described in like two sentences, right? But it is a book about a young man who works for a certain senator from Illinois who is running for president, and this young man goes to work on the campaign, right? But the book is really about a lot of other things, right? It is a type of book that I particularly tend to gravitate towards, where it is filled with meditations that feel like they are ingrained within the book itself, but also could be read independently as their own thing, where you really feel like the author is alive, right?
That's right. That, yeah.
Not everything is a sort of perfect performance, right? Not everything is this perfectly paced sort of whatever strange ideal that you learn in MFA program or something like that, where you have a structure that is being executed and that the point of the book is who can execute this the best, right? There are some books that are written in that sort of way that are good. This book, I will say, is not that, right? I think it is a book in which the author's brain is right there on the page. I don't know. I really appreciated that. And I was hoping that that's what this book would be like, just because of somebody who has known you for so long. I was like, man, I hope he doesn't lobotomize it, you know?
I wouldn't even know how. Yeah.
Yeah. I hope it's all there. So there's meditations about a lot. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of thinking about the church, a lot of thinking about God. There is a lot about the NBA, right? Which I thought was cool.
Thank you. There's a whole scene in there where the guy's watching a basketball game and thinking about
it. Oh, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about that.
Okay, good.
And music and family, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, the first question I had for you was that, you know, what is it? We both are similar in some ways in which we've done both, right? We've written fiction. And we've written nonfiction. And I think, I don't know if this is fair to say to you, but I will say that our careers as being magazine writers and sort of engage in journalism and criticism is kind of deeply strange to both of us, right? It's not what...
That's right.
Right. I admired magazine writers, but it was not what I wanted to do. Like, I wanted to be Dostoevsky or something like that, you know, when I was younger.
Yeah.
I like was much more interested in that side of it. So for you, like, what was it, what sort of compelled you to write a novel after all these, you know, years of, you know, successful years of as a critic journalist?
Yeah, I mean, as you know, like, you know, even as I was just starting to get into media, I always had in my mind that I wanted to write a novel. You know, it was something that was my kind of explicit goal. And, but I also wanted to make a living writing. And so, and criticism is one of those things that's kind of always there. I mean, at least it felt like that then. Now it feels a little bit more endangered as an enterprise, as does journalism generally. Right. But, it felt like, okay, I did admire magazine writers. I did read criticism and liked doing it. And I found out that I was good at it. So I did it. And as you mentioned, like I was able to, you know, work at the New York, all these wonderful things happened as a result of it. But that whole time I was like either thinking about or actively writing this book. So they kind of like are two things that have been happening on two like parallel tracks for me this whole time. And you know, I never like, you know, I didn't take a book leave. I didn't take any kind of time away from work to do this. So, it took a while to make it happen and make it be like apparent that I was doing these two things at the same time. But that's been the idea the whole time. And hopefully letting one strand of work and thought or whatever influence the other. Like, you know, the things that I was learning by doing New Yorker pieces, whether they be critical or journalistic, or ways of, you know, making a person enter the room or ways of describing a work of art or whatever. I think I was trying to also like make portable and kind of use it in this book as well.
Yeah, and let's get a bit into the weeds here, right? Like for writing discussion. And because I find that what I never understood while you're going through this process, just from a personal standpoint, was how you're able to switch back and forth between fiction and criticism journalism. It's something I've never been able to do myself. And while reading the novel, I was just so struck by, first of all, I was not surprised in any way that I thought it was beautifully written because, you know, I was like, well, I don't know. When's he going to write a bad sentence, right? Like, but then I was like, how is he writing these sentences when he has to go back and do this other stuff? Now, this is no knock on the New Yorker or anything like that, right? But there is a way to write magazine journalism.
Yeah,
that is very different than the generative act of writing fiction, at least for me, right? There are demands that are placed upon you. You have to, first of all, the thing you write has to make sense. Secondly, you can't go super crazy, right? I actually just turned in a piece to our mutual editor, and the end of it is nuts. It's all about like my cat wandering off, and it doesn't make any sense, you know, and I just put it in there, and I know it's not going to survive, but I was just like, I think maybe it's because I was reading your book, and I was just like, whatever, I'm putting it in, you know, I'm going
putting it in.
No one will ever read that except me and him, you know, but but
I'm sorry about your cat wandering off, man. I'm sorry.
Oh no, it's okay. I mean, we're very sad about it, but it's, you know, I don't know, there's something quite for the listeners of the show, my cat, a very, very elderly cat, did what I think some cats do at the end of life, and they wander off and they find somewhere to go and pass on to the next life. And there's something kind of poetic about it, you know? It's like,
yeah,
I'm going to bother you guys with, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm out.
There's something very like dignified about it. Like, you're not gonna watch me, you know.
Right, exactly. Like, I'm not gonna like wither away in front of you. I'm just gonna go find this hole over somewhere and you're never gonna see me again. And it is upsetting because, you know, it's tough to find some sort of closure, but I don't know, I do think it was dignified. But yeah, I was thinking about it, I was just like, man, how do you sort of give yourself the freedom that you need, right, to write fiction, to write the types of meditations that are in this book, right, that in some ways are risky from a formal standpoint, right? It's risky to have a chapter that is a sort of conversation at a bar that in some ways is a work of criticism about the basketball aesthetics of Paul Pierce, right? Like that's like risky. Nah, you know, like it's not risky if I'm your audience. you're throwing it right down the middle,
right, but, over the plate. Yeah,
yeah, it is a risk, right? I think as journalists, we're kind of taught to avoid those types of risks. These are not, you know, even at the New Yorker, right? And so, how did you sort of prepare your brain? I'm actually just asking, you know, in case I somehow like find the courage to write another novel.
Well, I have no doubt that you will. I don't know. It's just on some level the two worlds felt very close to me. Just like, you know, like trying to make sentences that convey a certain kind of information, especially like my critical writing. You know, when you write theater reviews, I found that criticism is space where like magazines actually kind of open up, and you can do weird things with time, and you can indulge the senses and do all these things that you can't necessarily do in whatever 8,000 word feature. The feature is such its own art that you are thinking more structurally or whatever than you are structurally, chronologically, whatever, than you are necessarily about sentence by sentence writing. But also it's just like it was a place where I could take things that I learned from magazine journalism and kind of set them free, you know, and do something that seemed like a long critical essay in the middle of a narrative moment or whatever, you know. It's like, I've always thought about this, like, if you do a theater review, as I do very often, but if you just at the beginning of it were to say, yeah, I walked in off the street and I sat down in the seat, and then you said everything that you said, and then you said, and then I left and went home, all of a sudden that's fiction, right? Like, the sort of, the moment you put a context around these like little snippets that we do that we call articles or pieces or whatever, the moment you put some life on one side and some life on the other side, it starts to resemble narrative. It starts to seem like fiction. So a lot of it was felt pretty similar to me, you know? But yeah, and also it's just like a thing of, just like you said, like leave it to the editor. Like I just try to do what I want. And a different, you know, a magazine editor has their prerogatives and a fiction editor has theirs. But I just try to, I try still to do what I want most of the time. I mean, it's like, if you're going to be a writer for a living, like you better be doing what you want a lot of the time, or else like you could do something else, right? Like you should at least be trying to do what you want.
Yeah. Yeah. The pay is bad and stressful and, you know, kind of, yeah, like you get to a point where anyone doesn't just laugh when they hear you say that you're a writer. So yeah,
you should have fun with it.
Yeah. All right. Well, were there other books that were sort of structured in this similar way? I guess what I found interesting was that when you read the description of these books, right, or of this book particular, I'm sure you're going to get this question a lot, and you might disagree with my characterization of it, mm-hmm. but it will be described as a book about a young man who worked for the Obama campaign. Right. And that it'll be a retrospection of whatever year that was. What year was that? 2008.
07, 08.
Yeah, 2008. 2007, 2008. And David, who is the narrator of the book, you know, there's a lot of very funny scenes. He sort of is thrust into this world where he suddenly is going to like very, very famous rappers' houses, you know, really famous hedge fund managers, finance people, and he's just being handed envelopes. Well, it was like $2,300, right?
That used to be the max back then. Yeah,
right. So you're just getting all these envelopes, right? Or the in that way, it's sort of set up to seem like it is going to be like a snapshot of this moment in time. What were the great hopes? And I think that in some ways, the book is that, right?
Yeah, but that is one strand of it. That's totally
right. I think that the Obama part of it is not like, it is not really a book about Obama, right? It is not a book that is just like a political memoir in any sort of sense. And so like, how did you sort of deal with that? Because it's this huge expectation, right? And I think, I don't want to give away too much here, but a lot of the details of the narrator's life match your life, right? You did do a lot of these, political jobs. You did work for Obama. You did. Right. You did attend a small liberal arts college in Vermont, et cetera, right?
That's right.
How did you deal with sort of setting up this big expectation that people might have at the beginning of the book, and then, you know, kind of wandering away from it to do what you want in a way that I found quite satisfying. Right. And then returning to it from time to time and not just going straight down the middle of being like, here's, you know, this is my life as an Obama staffer.
That's right. Well, so, yeah, David shares a lot, as you say, of biography with me. Things happen to him that never happened to me. He meets people. Some of them resemble close people that I met. Some of them are totally invented. So it's an interesting like mix there. But for me, it's like, okay, you choose a campaign as a setting, and therefore you have a beginning, a middle, and an end, right? So like referring to all of that, like there's a narrative built in that gives you, to me at least, more freedom. You know, I don't have to invent like, and then the, you know, the campaign bus had a bomb under it. You know, it's like, I don't have to do that. I don't have to, there's a built-in shape that I can then fill in with, as you say, all kinds of speculation and memory and ideas, things that read like essays, things that, you know, have the sort of whatever, like Proustian ring of memory, or like a sort of Henry James style, just walking into somebody's house and noticing every single thing about it or whatever, you know, just all the kinds of writing that I like to do. Like for me, the great thing about the novel, and it sounds really stupid, but the great thing about the novel is that it's just like a lot of prose. And therefore, it's like an open field. And it can contain many types of writing. And that was always the hope. It was like, how can I do, what kind of form is going to allow me to do as many of the things I like to do in writing as possible? You know, like, how do I create a book of everything in some sense? That's like located in this one guy in this one situation. And then though, once we get to learn him through his, you know, how he thinks, how the people that he meets, all these things, then I think it creates a, when he does turn his eye back toward the campaign that he's on and this candidate that he's following around, I think it makes those observations or that looking all the more sort of meaningful.
Right, and because the thing that he's looking at is so familiar to us, right? Evokes so much built-in emotion that in some ways it intensifies the observation because it is not a novel observation. It is one that we can compare to our own observations, right? Descriptions in the book of Obama were quite stunning, you know, in terms of it's something that you would think about him, but maybe you didn't know, right? It's just the sort of aloof grace that he walks around. like the narrator is constantly wondering if Obama knows who he is, right?
Which I don't remember me.
Yeah, does he know? He's like, does he remember? And then there's like this sort of
that's true.
Congeniality that he shows him, right? The narrator also sometimes kind of is like, wait, okay, he was really nice to me. It's almost like you have a crush on him. It's like, it's like, does he actually like me? Does he actually know who I am? Is this how he is with everybody?
Exactly. That's what he tells all the girls. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It was, I thought it was such an interesting choice just because in some ways it is quite risky because you are dealing with all these expectations, right? Well, the title of the novel is Great Expectations. And then running counter to them and being like, all right, well, we're really going to just sit in this bar for a while and talk about basketball. I thought it was cool. Like, I was just like, all right. Like I said before, I felt liberated as a writer, you know? I was like, can do interesting things. I don't know. I do think that the form of the novel is getting like this a little bit more these days, right? Like where it can be things. People read a lot of Melville now and they sort of take some lessons away from it, for example. But I don't know. I'm just happy that it was like this. I wanted to talk a little bit about the role of the church in this book. Because I think that, you know, it is a story about a young man. Stories about young men tend to be about seeking, right? And memory. And loss. And so, I mean, this wasn't something that you and I have known each other for a long time, you know, and this is not something that I knew that much about and that you thought about all that much, except in small snippets, right, that I would sort of pick it up. But why did you want to write so much about the church?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of things. I mean, it sort of inside the logic of the book, David is trying to negotiate like different forms of belief. You know, we're on a campaign whose candidate is like presenting himself like in this straightforwardly like messianic way. It makes sense that you would think about all the different ways that you've been taught to believe, like all the different modes of like following and, as you say, seeking that you've been sort of trained into. David often thinks about stuff like, you know, looks at something, you know, but there's a scene where he's on a boat on the way to Martha's Vineyard. He's looking at the water and he's thinking, like, how many ways have I been taught to think about this? Whether it's biblically or this or that, you know, the meanings of things have been conditioned by the different ways of life that I've been sort of educated into, whether it's like art or politics or religion. So that's like, so inside the logic of the book, I think it's that, just like a sort of counterbalance, that a counterpoint, you know, trying to achieve all these different modes of belief. Outside the logic of the book, just like me, to your point about just like indulging my own interests, like I was raised in a very religious environment. I still, you know, go to church when I can rouse myself. It's something that is really important to me. And I think I've always loved like artistic descriptions of, especially like intense, like charismatic Black religion. Like James Baldwin's first novel, Go Tell It on the Mountain, happens at a shut-in service at a Pentecostal church or whatever. And it's like that I wanted to just like contribute to that literature because it's something that I have been a part of that I think is, it's weird. First of all, a lot of artists and writers have no exposure to this. So we don't get, even though it's a big part of so many people's lives, it's not depicted that often in art, just because of like, you know, who artists and writers tend to be. It makes all sense in the world. And especially, you know, Pentecostalism, for example, it's just like, I don't know. I think it's under-described. And so it was just a challenge to me to talk about this atmosphere of like mysticism and magic that was so important to my consciousness. It's like it struck me as material that I, you know, wanted to see if I could just rise to the challenge of describing.
Right. There is a description of the pastor, an older pastor, right, in the book, and it struck me as so reminiscent of Notes of a Native Son, where Baldwin is describing his father, you know, and that then I just realized that, yeah, it's like it is both under written about, and then there's also this sort of rich forebear for it, right?
Right.
Where it is quite evocative and interesting. Like the thing that you talked about before, I wanted to go back to this idea of like, well, what do you believe in? And you know, there's a lot of photography has this very interesting role in this novel. There's large, long passages where you're just describing photographs, right? Or where the narrator is describing photographs. And, you know, I won't give away the end of the book, but there is a, you know, a moment of photography there as well. And it struck me, and it seemed like, I think that, and I don't want to, this is my speculation, is that.
Yeah.
The idea of what we're looking for is not affixed in any type of way, right? That, like Obama, that it is almost captured in small moments that we put in our head, right? And that, but the actual figure itself is quite all over the place, right? There's no way to really pin down what it is that is appealing or why it is so meaningful. And that what it ends up being, much like Obama was, is this collection of icons that are created that evoke different emotions, right? And that ends up being who he is. And I think the question that you're asking is, in the book, is, well, who is anyone else except this, right? Like, what sort of relations do we have towards different people? But I know that it's, you know, this is where I felt like the criticism part was so interesting, where it's like, I know this is something you've written about and thought about a bit, right? Like, and so, yeah, like, can you just take me through, like, why the sort of ideas, or not the ideas behind it, it's just like, I don't know, it's like sort of when somebody asks, like, what are the themes in your book? It's such like a invasive and odd question. But like, can you just talk a bit about you know, the photography in the book, you know, the use of the thinking about it?
It is a way, I think you're so right, like that you create icons and you create fictions, regardless of whatever your approach to photography is. But it's like, the scene you're describing was one of my favorites to write. He, David goes to the Rose Bowl flea market in Los Angeles and is walking. And if you've ever been there, which I did once, not in connection with the campaign, but I sort of transmuted it into this because I just like, the as I was walking around that place, I was like, I have to turn this into something. There is a part of it that's like, they sell old photographs. I'm sure they just find them at like estate auctions and, you know, in people's storage units or abandoned storage units or whatever. And, you know, looking at those, I still own some of the ones that I described in the book. You see someone and then what you do is speculate, you know, their pose or the way they hold their face or the way they hold their hands or the way they, you know, are surrounded by what seems to be their families prompts you to make little things of conjecture. You know, you have, you establish some form of belief based on it, almost like this, like detective work of like, what could this be? And who is this, the daughter? Is this, you know, you immediately create story in the way that we do about each other all the time. You know, David also was like always asking other people, like, where do you come from? Or how'd you grow up or whatever? Just like trying to break whatever like sort of pain of mystery that exists between the self and other people, you know? And so I think I have always been in my life very conscious of that. Like the sheer number of assumptions I make when I like literally see something. And I think that has to do with like, that has everything to do with like, especially like political belief, like how people stage and pose and project onto us and make us like feel things that are sometimes wordless. You know, sometimes you don't even know you think something about a person until you like are forced to verbalize it, you know? So that like icon making, David's also really interested in statues and sometimes stops and looks at a statue and tries to deconstruct it in his mind. That kind of icon making is really, you know what's funny to me? And this goes to the NBA. It's like the most honor that we can give an NBA player is like, you know, he's going to get a statue outside.
I know. I feel like that's outside. New. But yeah, it's become the number one thing, you know?
It's like the thing. Yeah. And it's like, wow, you know, we still care about like visual memorials or monuments, things that like take people out of their context and try to like, you know, immortalize or whatever. And we do this all the time.
Because it also reflects something about the people who put up this statue, you know? Like, Asia Wilson has a statue outside of, at the University of South Carolina of Asia Wilson, right? She's the great at USC, not the California one, the South Carolina one, women's basketball player. And I always found that so interesting that they would, you know, I was like, well, it reflects something about the importance, if nothing else, you know, like it reflects something about the importance of women's basketball to that university, right?
That's right. That's right.
And in that way, it's almost more like Asia Wilson is, you know, of course she was going to have, if you were going to put up a statue of a women's basketball player, you're going to put that up. But I just found it to be kind of like touching and maybe actually like the University of South Carolina before I had no opinion of it at all, you know? Yeah.
Asia Wilson's so good, by the way. It's unbelievable.
It's like basically the perfect basketball player. It's just like, you know, I don't know what else one would want. But the way, I don't know. I think that happened because, I'm trying to think what the first, I think it maybe in the modern discourse started because there was debates about whether Shaq would get like a trophy outside of Staples Center. And then there's all these Lakers fans, and the Lakers fans who love Kobe say, LeBron's never getting a statue outside of state. Of course he will, you know?
Of course.
but they're going to be mad about the statue, right? Because to them,
he's not a Laker.
Yeah, he's not a Laker. He's not. And also, like, I think there's some sort of trauma thing with Kobe going on, right? Where it's like accepting LeBron means that like Kobe has actually passed type of thing happening with Lakers fans, which I do feel somewhat sympathetic about.
It's like a kid being like, "You're not my real dad." It's something like that.
It is that. That's what it is. You know,
you can't tell me anything. You're not my dad.
I also,
He's been there for you. He's the dad who stepped up.
Oh, yeah. And, like, you guys, I mean, like, you didn't get a, like, the bubble thing, fine, whatever. But, like, you know, like, I'm sorry, you're completely irrelevant winning 25 games before this dude showed up. And now you're.
Come on.
Yeah, just stop. But the, yeah, I think it's for NBA fans, it's much more important than something like the Hall of Fame, which is not important, right? Because the statue actually reflects the local fan consensus more than anything.
Right.
And so it becomes super important to them. So like in Philadelphia, Allen Iverson statue is important to people of Philadelphia in a way that Allen Iverson making the Hall of Fame is almost an abstract conversation to other people. It's just like, sure, you know, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
you know, it sort of, even if you never see the statue, it reflects something about that. Okay, let's just talk about the NBA now.
Let's do it.
There's this long chapter
uh-huh.
where there's a, David walks into a bar, right? And the Pistons are playing. Right? And there's Paul Pierce comes on the television. And David has a conversation with his friend and the bartender about Paul Pierce, right? And about sort of the aesthetics of Paul Pierce. I love this section, obviously. But yeah, just tell me, why don't you describe it a little bit to me? What does David think about Paul Pierce?
Yeah.
What are his theories of Paul Pierce?
Well, he likes Paul Pierce a lot because Paul Pierce seems to like have his flaws, as opposed to he's thinking actually about Paul Pierce and Kobe Bryant. And like, whereas, you know, the ethos of Kobe Bryant, we all now know this as like Mamba mentality, is that you like ruthlessly and relentlessly like not only augment your strengths, but eliminate your weaknesses one by one and like try to achieve like perfection, you know, through effort and a performance of effort. Whereas with a guy like Pierce, he has flaws. You can tell he's not always working out. You can tell he like follows his other interests. He like, you know, goes out and parties to the point where it's not his fault, but like he's out without a bodyguard. Paul Pierce got stabbed and almost lost his life, you know?
Right.
You can tell Paul Pierce has other priorities. I don't know if that's actually true about Paul Pierce, but that's what it always seemed like to me and how it seems to David.
No, it seems to be true, especially, you know, his post-playing career. Sort of pouring that out. Yeah. He talks about it quite a bit with Kevin Garnett. Yeah,
he's that's like, right. He's like, you know, drinking, hanging out, whatever. And true creativity, you know, and David's always thinking about, like, what is it to, like, really have a personality? What is it to really be creative, not just in, like, art, but, like, in making a self? It's like, no, you create moves based on your weaknesses. Like Paul Pierce's spin move is about how slow he is, like, because he's not going to beat you on the first step and he's not going to like be above the rim. He's created a game. He's sort of the limit of his physicality and his whatever work ethic, whatever, has created opportunities for him to express himself creatively. It's like, you know, he has fashioned himself around who he is. And for David, so he's having this argument with this guy who's the bartender at the place he goes to with his friends, where the other guy's is like, no, like, I appreciate this effort of somebody like Kobe Bryant. And David's like, no, man, what it is to like love aesthetics is to like see what somebody makes out of themselves, like see what somebody can fashion out of a flawed, necessarily limited self. And so they're going back and forth about this. With this guy, the guy's name is Prince, and he is like he lives in New Hampshire where they are at this point in the campaign. David's gone to New Hampshire to work on the primary there. And so this like discourse is something I think about all the time. I was like, I'm going to like put these two sides of my brain into these two characters' mouths.
Yeah, the Paul Pierce thing is, I mean, I find that the comparison to Kobe is correct, and that the Paul Pierce thing was mostly like, for me at least, it was okay. How does he do? He was always described as like a shifty player, right? Like somebody who could kind of make do with certain shifts in weight. So he would get you on his hip and then he would bump you very subtly, and then you'd be right over there, and then he would have the space to hit his shot. And this is part of the reason why he fell in the draft, because people thought that he wouldn't be able to accomplish that type of game of subtleties, because at some level you go to the NBA, and in college you do six subtle things. The guy gets off, you get your shirt off. In the NBA, you do all the same things. The guy reacts all the same ways. You get the shot off, and then he just jumps a foot in there and throws the ball in his hands. And so,
right.
I don't know. I watch a lot of Paul Pierce's career because I was in Boston when he was sort of coming up with the Celtics. Not in Boston, in Maine, I'm sorry. In college when the Celtics were coming up, and he had those teams with Antoine Walker, and man, I love those teams, and it was just because both guys were sort of seen as being flawed. Like Antoine Walker is basically, you know, in some ways had a big hand in inventing modern basketball, where big men just run up and down the court and shoot threes,
jack threes. Antoine used to just jack threes and like happily walk back every day.
Yeah, and all the sports writers, everyone would be scandalized, you know. It's like similar, and then they didn't realize that he actually had seen the future, right? It was like like in baseball, you remember all these conversations that now I think about it, and it's like you are in a bar or something like that, and you're watching baseball, and people are like, just hit the ball between second and third gently so that the run can score, you know, that's all we need, right? Like, stop trying to hit the ball out of the ballpark. And then we realize how stupid those people were.
You know? Yeah, no, you should be gunning for it every time.
Yeah. Why don't you, like, why are they not bunting? Is this manager not understand, like, the subtleties in the game within the game? And you're like, no, actually, like, we're all stupid. You know, I thought those things too. How could you not? Like, it's not like I, like, understood baseball at some elemental or advanced level. But yeah, Paul Pierce, it was like the mix of competitiveness that he was like, he had that very famous series against the Indiana Pacers that I think I watched every minute of, where he was just destroying Al Harrington, you know, and just yelling at him, and he hit every single shot. But yeah, it was weird because it's not like he's getting much elevation on the shot. It's just like all weird stuff. And I think that there was a point of it where it was like what he represented in the league was just kind of this dude who wasn't that talented, who also didn't seem at times to win very much, right? Because before Kevin Garnett got there, they lost all the games. And then he sort of like became this elder statesman of toughness and whatever for a little bit. But I always liked it. I always found it admirable. I think that the Kobe part of it is that there was a cleanness to it, not obviously to his personal life or whatever, but there was a cleanness to his game where it was just this pursuit of absolute perfection, and the model for was quite clear. It's just Michael Jordan, right?
They're like just being like Michael Jordan.
Right. Who can he do like the perfect Michael Jordan impression? And that is somewhat alienating because it takes the person out of it, right? It takes the creator out of it, and it just becomes a pursuit of something. Although Kobe Bryant was a better player than Paul Pierce.
We can just say that. And he was amazing. I enjoyed watching Kobe. But Paul Pierce always seemed to me like, wow, that is a person like expressing their individuality.
You feel through, that way like, about who do you feel that way about now? Like, who do you feel like is the Paul Pierce of today, where it's
It's so funny because I think there are fewer and fewer of those guys. Like, when we were coming up, there would just be a guy with a fucked up jump shot, you know?
Right.
Everybody has the same jump shot now. Everybody has, the same step back, the same Euro step. It's like aesthetics have kind of regularized, except the extreme cases like Steph Curry, like, obviously, like, self-expression. You and I went to a Warriors game together like 2 years ago, and Steph Curry had just like Draymond had just come back from injury, and Steph like responded to that by scoring like 47 points. You know,
I know. I was so happy that happened because it was like, I was like, well, I hope if this is the only game, and your daughter was there too, and I was like, man, I really hope Steph goes off, you know, because it is exciting in a way when he's doing that in front of the home fans, where it's just like, it really is thrilling.
Yeah.
And with the anticipation where you're just like, that's going in. And then it's just, you know, like it's great. Yeah.
It's amazing. I think it's, you know, honestly, I think it's Jokic. Like Jokic plays differently. Like he just doesn't look like anybody else on the court. Like even the way he like waddles up and down, he just looks like different on the court. in a way that almost nobody does anymore. Like, we used to have, like, you know, the Derek Colemans and guys who were just flagrantly out of shape. Like, none of that happens anymore. Like, and I'm not saying Jokic is out of shape. I think he's in perfect shape to do what he does. But he just, like, looks different out there, expresses himself bodily way differently than anyone else. Also on his team, I think Michael Porter Jr. is a crazy person and just kind of does whatever he wants, even though, I mean, he has like a normal jump shot. He like has all the like moves, but just his decision-making process is sometimes I'm like, what is going on with that guy?
Yeah, I think it was because he was always the best player in the country growing up from like sixth grade on with Michael Porter
right.
Jr. Yeah, he was
like, and he still thinks he is. He still thinks he's the best player in the NBA.
Yeah, yeah.
In a way that's not endearing.
In a way that's not endearing at all.
Oh, no.
I had this. The place I used to play cards in LA, the Commerce Casino. Russell Westbrook would sometimes show up and play Pot Limit Omaha. Anyway, I never played with Russ. Yeah, I never played with him because obviously he was playing bigger games. But sometimes his friends would play in the games that were smaller. And I remember there was one time I was talking to his friend, and he was like. He's like, Russ thinks it's like LeBron and him and that's it, you know?
A few years there, he might have been right, but that's still just funny because...
Yeah. No, this is like literally 2 years out of UCLA or something like that. You know? It always struck me that, you know, that conversation always sort of stuck with me because I felt like Russ went about that belief in a way that was ultimately endearing to me, although sometimes quite annoying. But Michael Porter Jr. just does it in an annoying way, you know?
Yeah, so annoying.
Like, I don't actually enjoy this confidence that you have.
He just thinks any moment everybody's going to realize who's been powering that team, you know?
Yeah. You think Jokic could do what Jokic did if it wasn't for me?
Without me?
Yeah, he'd be fine, you know? Yeah, Jokic is a tough one for me because I want to be resistant to him because there's just so much, you know, breathlessness about him.
There's a huge consensus now. Like nobody even says anything else. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, it's just so obvious that he's one of the best players we've ever seen and one of the most interesting and fun to watch players we've ever seen. And so now I've just given in and I just enjoy it. You know, it's like the passing is as a connoisseur of passing and somebody who would rather see a team not be good but pass well than be awesome and shoot well. it's really revelatory. He's probably like the best passer of all time at this point. It's just
he's
outrageous.
Awesome.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about Obama specifically, right?
Sure,
this can be outside of the context of the novel as well, which was, you know, I was like, how much did you want the reader to have Obama occupy their brains while they were reading this book, right? Like, how much space did you want him to take up? Because that's the book's big risk, right? That
sure
he will end up swallowing everything else up.
Yeah, I wanted them. You know, I think, and it's not a novel theory, but I think one of the things I think about Obama is that he is kind of this Rorschach onto which people project all different kinds of things. So the good thing about having someone like him and then further abstracting them, not speaking their name, even though you know who it is, and having them move and walk and talk like this person, but leaving their meaning sort of indeterminate, is that people can bring their own thoughts about that person into it so that, you know, I think it has this sort of doubling of memory effect that like David is offering his memories and his conjectures and his kind of analysis, but that you can do the same thing at the same time so that it creates like a double stream of thought, you know, that you're sort of like truly inviting the reader to at least a contemporary reader. God knows if this book, you know, survives and people read it later on, I don't know if that effect will still pertain. But I think now, you can kind of be musing along with David in a way that I think is helpful to a book to like sort of like create some like adhesive material between my mind working and yours.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it accomplished that just because he drops out in a way, right? Where these sort of long expository passages or whatever.
That's right.
But the idea of the Rorschach, I thought was quite interesting. I was, I had not thought about Obama for a long time. And then last summer, I spent quite a bit of time in Hawaii. And near the school that he attended, right, Punahou, which is sort of the private school, and it's a fancy private school in Honolulu. And it made me, it's just so strange that it made him seem even stranger to me.
Really? Why?
Think of him in the context of Hawaii, right? Like, where you imagine this young kid running around Honolulu, and it is foreign in a way, not obviously foreign in like it's not the United States or whatever, but it is not, it is different, right? Very different context in which to grow up. And then the construction of who he became, which the book does go into, right? With Jeremiah Wright and everything like that. I found it quite generative to think about again, where I was like, man, it's so odd that he grew up there. And in some ways, it is like the most telling part of his identities, right? Is that he grew up. It's just generally how I think, right? It's like, well, there's the way in which we are perceived by the world, and there's the identities that are foisted upon us, some of which we welcome, some of which we don't. But that there is also this sort of personal history that is born out of the setting in which we come of age. And for Obama, that was Hawaii, and I think that people kind of don't think about him in that sort of way. They don't think about him really as Hawaiian, right? They don't think about my favorite clip of Obama ever is him body surfing.
I remember that. Yeah,
he's like quite good at it, and I was always so impressed by that, not because it was like, oh, the president can body surf, but body surfing is hard, right? You have to have done it a lot.
Yeah.
And then it sort of brought up this whole history of him that we weren't really never front and center. It was never front and center. Now, it was in the book, obviously. It's a memoir right, of his book, right? Not your book. But,
But usually it's something that has slid by. The fact that he lived there, the fact that he spent time growing up in Indonesia. Like, these things that are just don't fit into our conception of first black president or whatever.
Right. We want to think about him as if he's from Chicago, right? We want to think about him as if he is a guy who grew up in the South Side of Chicago and, went to church and became a community organizer to help the people that he grew up with, right?
Yeah,
but it's just not that at all.
He's at all.
Why going to Punahou? And it was really sort of reading your novel, it sort of really hammering that home, which is just what do we really know about this guy, and it's is there a president that's been more unknowable in our lifetimes, that where he is so beloved, and yet I don't know. I know who Donald Trump is,
who that guy is.
Right. Yeah. I know all of his little foibles, and I can understand I can draw a straight line from A to B about why he's doing something. I'm pretty sure I'm right every single time, as is anyone with an operating brain,
That's right.
But with Obama, it's just I don't know. There's this sort of mystery around it. And I thought that I was wondering how that played into the writing of this book, right? This idea that do we really know him? Because David, the narrator, does not really, right? And he's always thinking about that. Like we said before, that's why he's always did he recognize me? Yeah.
Yeah, it's so funny. I don't know about you, but I almost feel like the further we get away from that campaign and that presidency, the less we know what happened, really. It's what was that? Yeah.
Why did that work?
Yeah. You kind of thought it would be oh, wow, the first black president. And he would just be more and more sainted as we went on. And maybe that'll happen in 100 years. But now it's kind of like a fog. It's what happened? And maybe it's the way he's conducted himself post-presidency. It's not like he's gone about building a sort of Johnny Appleseed mythology for himself or whatever. Where it's just what you said about Trump. You could do the same thing, just not beat for beat biography, but just sort of archetypically. You could do that about George W. Bush. You could do that about Clinton. You could do that about George H.W. Bush. You could do like Reagan. They all have these stories that just like boom, 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 boom. And it's like, not just this is what an American president is like, but it's like, he's this kind of American archetype that we, you know, and whatever, he's the smartest version of that. And he became the president, but it's like, for every Bill Clinton, there's a bunch of guys that are like Bill Clinton, except they own car dealerships. And then for every guy like George W. Bush, there's a million guys just like that who are like the, you know, just are like the laziest partner at their white shoe law firm. And, you know, like we just know these types. And Obama is weirdly not a type.
No, and, he's a total mystery, right?
It's, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm with you. I don't quite. One of the things I think to answer that question about what happened, or not to answer, but to just mention, you know, I remember I used to play in this card game at the Upright Citizens Brigade on 23rd Street.
And oh my God. Week, under that Gristides?
No, it was like on the second floor. I think they moved it, but it was.
Oh, okay.
It was in Chelsea. It was next to one of the papaya spots. Anyway, every week they would have like a big poker tournament, and you know, you go there, and it was early enough where people like Matt Walsh or whoever were not that famous, right?
Yeah.
The guy Harry from Mad Men was like a guy who was very nice. I was not an Upright Citizens Brigade. I was just a degenerate gambler, but
you just like found their game, yeah.
Yeah, a friend of mine was part of it, and he told me that I didn't even do very well there. But you know, it's like it's like sort of my days of thinking that playing in underground or finding games in New York City was glamorous. I think I was 23 years old at the time.
Amazing.
Or I don't know how, but it was. I remember there was this day where I came in, and it was right after Obama had given his speech at the DNC, right? The
2004
kid with a funny name, right?
Yeah,
speech, and he's. Dudes who, by the way, are like comedians, and so they're the most just kind of awful, performatively cynical people ever who just are trying out. I mean, honestly, this game was intolerable at times because, you know, it's just a bunch of improv comedy dudes like doing bits to each other.
Doing bits all the time.
Yeah, I'm just sitting there just being like, please make it stop. But they were listening to this speech on their iPods. And like tearing up and just listening to over and be like, bro, that was so sick type of vibe.
That's hilarious at a poker game.
Yeah, I feel like it was that spell just never did not dissipate for a very long time.
Yeah.
And that we did not like it was just kind of this perfect human had descended down and had saved us from the Clintons and all this bullshit, you know?
Yeah.
And that gave us something to really fill. It's just like it says in the book, like we've talked about, it's just a vessel in which you can fill everything up, and the emptier the vessel, the better. Now that is not a reflection of his politics, you know, like I actually find it quite annoying how some members of the left have, like, I think we've got overcorrected a little bit and talking about, you know, like and being mad at Obama.
Yeah. It's like he's like the worst one. They hate him more than they hate Bill Clinton. It's like, not.
Yeah. They hate him sometimes more than they hate Trump. We're just like, dude, come on. Are you kidding? But yeah, it was like, even then we didn't know anything about him. He had just given this speech. And then I don't know. I think about it. I was like, I don't know if we still know anything about him. You know, the only gossip I've ever heard about him, somewhat germane to the book, was when I went to Martha's Vineyard and the people who were there were sort of gossiping about him. Yeah. That's the closest I've gotten. So, yeah, I don't know. It was.
Yeah, I think what he is like talented, you know? I think he has politics, and I think he obviously has a rich inner life on some level. Like, he's a real writer. Like, when you read his writing, he's good. But as a political performer, he like really is just like talented in the way that like Aretha Franklin's talented. He's just, like really good at that. You know what I mean? So at creating a persona, at appearing in public, at like literally like walking to a podium and standing behind it, he just has like a presence. And it is more the skill set of an entertainer than it is whatever the other thing is, you know? And so I think that he is really good at putting forward you know, political projections or whatever, and seeming to, you know, showing us his daughters and showing us his wife and talking about their home life in a way that like sounds intimate in the moment. And then afterwards, it's like, wait, I don't know anything about that. You know, you ever meet somebody like that where like,
talk
for hours and hours and they're sharing with you and you're sharing with them, but you realize like, did he really even say anything? You know what I mean? It's like, he's good at that. And I don't know. I think it makes him, I don't think this is going to be the last novel that like takes him up as like a character, because I think that's an interesting kind of person to play with and like, and try to figure out and understand in a way that like other presidents might make a cameo, but of course, like, again, they bring these, like their total legibility with them. So it's like, oh, they're in this book, whatever. But this guy is like someone that we're still trying to figure out. And I think fiction is a good place to keep thinking through what a person, what an identity is, you know? And if nothing else, he's just like tried on so many identities. And like,
it almost feels like a right-wing talking point, but that's sort of in the end the great lesson of his life, right? Which is that sort of struggling with all these different identities, and in some ways he just becomes all of them, right? And that he's able to talk to everyone because of it. That's why the Hawaii thing is so interesting to me. It's like, well, how is that useful to him? But I'm sure that when he got to Harvard or something like that, it made him feel almost more unsettled, right? Because it's like he's in this totally new environment. Did you feel, you know, just this is speaking as you, not as, you know, not within the context of the book, but given that, was there any insight that you got into that question, you know, just from working?
About him?
Yeah, about him. Like, you know, like what is animating this guy?
No, and I don't think you would from the position that I was in. Right. You know, like David, I was a fundraising staffer. I would literally like see him into a room and see him out of a room. I would like, you know, show him a piece of paper with, here's the name of this person, da 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 da. And he, you know, he was perfectly polite. Sometimes you could see him like, you know, get a little, if he was tired and get a little irritable, you know, might, you know, gently yell at somebody real quick, you know. He just seemed like a guy that was like in between gigs, you know, like he didn't, you know, not that he was like turning it off or on, but he was just like kind of like on his way to the next thing, thinking about how the effect that he was having, you know, being like, oh, you know, if you overhear him, maybe it's saying like, oh, we should have said this at the end of the, or that should have been on the screen, or if you wanted me to say the website, it should have, you know, things like that. But like, and so I'm sure there are other people at other levels of that campaign that have a real answer, you know, here's who that guy is, for me, it was just like seeing somebody that I had seen on TV and then seeing them in real life, which is like, is already a weird thing. You know, when you see somebody that you've seen on TV, they always look kind of wrong. They look like they're kind of made up, you know, like the face looks too big or something like that.
Yeah.
It's just like, it changes how they look in real life.
Living in LA is like that constantly. You just sort of see people.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that's that person. And then you're generally less impressed, you know?
Yeah.
One person I will say I had the opposite feeling with was Kristen Stewart. She sat down next to me in a coffee shop and I was like, oh my God, that's like the most attractive person I've ever seen in my entire life. But anyway,
I believe it.
We don't have to be so horny.
My friend Collier Shore, the photographer, took some amazing pictures of Kristen Stewart for Rolling Stone, which made her look, in fact, like the most attractive person on the planet.
Oh my God. So I mean, I believe it. Yeah, it had been like 30 straight people I had seen where I've been like, yeah, you know, I guess makeup and photography is great. And then Kristen Stewart, I was like, oh my God. like they are not doing her justice.
Need a better camera to capture. Yeah. But yeah, it was just constant, just like seeing him in these backstage moments for a couple of minutes at a time. And the work of like knowing him was more like trying to figure something out than really like arriving at a higher state of knowledge or something like that.
Got it. Yeah. It's, I think your explanation is quite compelling in that maybe it's just talent. I was a television correspondent, I thought about this quite a bit in a way that I had never thought about it before, which was that there was a talent to being on TV and talking, and that some people had it and that I unfortunately did not, right? Which there is a, and that it is sort of based on the warmth that you evoke to the viewer, and that it is quite ineffable, and that it is very little to do with what you look at. Like, actually, there are plenty of very, very attractive news anchors that are still kind of,
you know, not that good at,
hanging out at, you know, some local news station, because, and then there's a lot of people who are quite famous who are the opposite, right? And
yeah,
I always thought about it in terms of Keith Olbermann, whereas, like, this man has the talent in a way that I've never, maybe he's the most talented person ever, because what he's saying is so fucking stupid.
But he's just, like, saying in this tone.
He was so good. You know, it's just like, you watch his monologues and you're just like, oh my God. You know, like, there is a performance here that is working on a level of me emotionally, where even though I am repulsed or just, like, baffled by what he's saying, I'm just going to keep watching. Right? He's just compulsively watchable. And whatever the political version of it, I guess that was really the explanation of it, because I can't really think of anything
else.
It's
hard to, well, two of your friends, I guess, I would call myself, like, friendly, distant acquaintances of them, but you're, like, their friends, are people like this too. To go back to sports for a second, Pablo Torre and Mina Kimes are both amazing at being on TV. Like, you just feel like you're their friend. They, like, their gaze seems to reach into your living room or whatever. It's just like, these people are amazing at this.
Like, I am.
Boom.
Pablo and I have talked, had many, many long conversations about Keith Olbermann, you know, especially when I was starting advice. Because I asked him, I was like, because I was struggling so much with being on camera. And because I'm stubborn, I didn't want to just give up immediately. And because I'm a narcissist, but I was like, I'm not going to give up on this. And, but I couldn't figure it out. And so I kept texting him and I was like, how do you do this? You know, like, this is impossible for me. And he's like, I don't know, man. I just watch a lot of cable news and watch, you know, Keith Olbermann's the best at it, you know? And so then I would, and then, but then it started to click. Now, the knowledge did not transfer to me into better performance, but, like, I felt like I at least understood what it was that made
what
somebody
like,
good at this. But yeah, I mean, Mina is like, you know, I don't, it's like unbelievable. It's like 100% approval rating as like an
so
Asian
good.
Woman who talks about football is just nuts. Now, of course, they're like shitheads who say stupid shit. But then she, like, dunks on, I don't know, I don't want to, like, I don't want to say too many nice things about Mina, you know. But I love Mina, so I'm like, whatever. It's a joke. Yes. But I remember there's this woman who worked on Vice with me who was who now is, like, on MSNBC, is really quite successful and was really, really good at television, right? Where I was just like, okay, you got it, I don't, right? But at some point she was telling me, she's like, I love Mina Kimes so much. When she dunks on those awful dudes, it's like, it's inspiring to me. And I was like, amazing. Man, this like, I wish that I had, you know, I can't even imagine having that effect. I think that my effect at the very best is, like, begrudging respect, you know?
But it's better than that. It's better than that.
All right, man. I want to let you go so that you can go enjoy your publication day. But, man, congratulations. This is awesome.
I wouldn't spend it any other way. Thank you, man. This has been great.
Is there anything you want to, like, are there any events or anything like that you want to tell the people about? This will be out tomorrow morning. Is there anything that they should do other than just very, very, very much pick up this great novel?
Yeah. Great Expectations comes out. It is out now as you listen to this, wherever you buy books. If you live in New York, I will be at Greenlight Books at 7:30 with my colleague Doreen St. Felix. We'll be talking about the book. We're filling in some other dates along the way, but I should mention on April 20th, I'm going to be at the LA Times Book Fair. So if you're on the West Coast, maybe that's something that you could check out. But more dates will be appearing on my, you know, social media and all that stuff. If you buy the book, I'll be very grateful. Thank you.
Buy the book. Yeah, we'll put a link in it, and we'll if you come to the Bay Area, we'll throw a little thing for you. We did that
Let's
for a while. I was actually really wonderful. These people,
that sounds awesome.
Some of the podcast fans brought these little bags that I think I posted that in our group chat, where they, you know, it's like a mixer bag. It's a very San Francisco thing.
I remember, yeah.
They brought him one. He was very touched. It was great. It was like one of my proudest moments of being podcast host. So. all right. Well, number one repeat guest, Vincent Cunningham,
yeah,
in the show. If you'd like to support the show, it's $5 a month at goodbyes.substack.com. If you want to email us, it's timetosaygoodbyepod@gmail.com. And then we will talk to you next week. I think Tyler should be back by then. He is on a family trip right now. All right. Bye.
Thank you.